This year, more than ever, we have witnessed the consequences of a system that is unjust, unequal, and oppressive right in front of our faces. It has been impossible to get away from the consequences of this system and these oppressive forces and see their impact all around us, directly involving every single one of us and implicating all of us into a system of oppression and injustice that goes towards the heart of every single person living in our nation and across the globe. And it's very, very important that a lot of us take the time to be self-respective, to have that moment of introspection, and to look towards what we can do directly around us to support those in the struggle against the capitalistic, bourgeois, oppressive global forces that are breaking down the world that we live in and making it unlivable day by day. Yet we should also be well aware of the limitations of this introspection, this limitations of this self-reflection, and this individualistic outlook on our world, whether that is within our own communities, or whether that is our own nation or our own continent perhaps. Injustice does not end at a border. Rather, it continues to bleed across the world and affects those who are forgotten a lot more than we may give credence. That's why it's important today more than ever to understand the struggle that our Indian brothers and sisters are going through against the fascistic, tyrannical government that is Modi's Indian government. We have to understand the importance of this. And today, I ask for a moment that we extend our support, our fight, and our struggle towards those who we may forget. And it is important that we continue to understand that the same devices, the same ploys, the same acts that political forces use within our countries are mirrored in countries that we may not give credence to. And to also recognize that injustice anywhere is an injustice everywhere. Welcome to the Left Wing Propaganda Machine. It is your host, producer, extraordinaire philosopher and political commentator, Mohammed Hassan. As usual, I'm here to give you another topic, another issue, another thought, or many thoughts to delve into today. And today is an important one. And what I usually try to do with any sort of political sort of issues or products of our time that are currently going on, to try and look at the bigger picture surrounding them and what we can do. But today is definitely focused on the Indian protest and what is going on. These have been happening for the past couple of weeks. I believe they started last week or the week before from the time of recording this. And I have been, of course, not quick to kind of cover these things because A, I was very busy with examination and university stuff. As usual, this time of year is very, very kind of filled with all of those things. But I also wanted to take time to sort of research and delve more into the issue surrounding that, the actual legal implications and the judicial forces that the government are using and the actual legislation they're putting forward. So it took me a bit more research and some more time, but I have come forward with this episode for this week. And also thank you quickly to all of the people who have been sending me amazingly motivational messages. I have been reading them. I've been trying to respond to as many of them as possible as I can. I might not get it straight away because sometimes your messages goes into my DM requests area in my social media. And essentially that means that I don't get to see the notification straight away unless I go into my messages, but I will eventually one day see them and get back to you. So thank you for anyone who sent me a message. I really appreciate it. But today, what is the focus? The focus is, as I said, on India and our solidarity with the Indian farmers going on. And also a sort of more of a message to those people who live in countries like America, like countries like Europe, like the UK, any kind of country that is sort of industrialized and we would say more forward or richer, or these sort of quote-unquote first world countries where it's very sort of easy to focus on a nation's problems, where there are many problems here in our nation for sure, but also we have to understand that the struggle against oppressive forces is that is one which is global, that the fight for these things does not end at our borders, that we have to look beyond our oceans and seek the common humanity that links us all together, whether we are black, brown, European, Asian, African, South American, it simply does not matter. We must be against injustice everywhere, which is why it is important for us, particularly as leftists, particularly as people who are struggling against capitalistic forces, to understand this specific protest, because there is also a lot to learn. The arrogance, a lot of times, of political commentary and political sort of discourse from Europe seems to be this sort of European savior, or this sort of like savior complex, in which we have this image and that we will fix our countries, and then we will essentially go through this process of neocolonization and go to these other countries and extend our amazing hands, until you realize that that is exactly the same process that the slave trade essentially profited off, that sort of messaging, and the exact same thing that colonizing forces use to sort of kind of justify their movement. So we have to learn that these people are not barbaric idiots. They are people who are able to organize and able to fight against forces better than us at sometimes, particularly when you realize that these people are not as pacified by commodity forces and by materialistic market forces that make them see the world through these lenses of commodity fetishism, and see that these people actually truly have a massive stake in their lives and are willing to fight from it, something that we all can learn a message from. But let us get into the case right now of what is occurring around India, what is actually going on right there. So essentially the breakdown of this, and I have the actual laws and legislations in front of me, which I will go over as I said, but what is going on is that there's essentially farmer protests who are protesting against legislation that would essentially weaken the unions, essentially, or the representative forces of these farmers, into and essentially make it so that the big corporations and the wholesale retailers have more power in dictating the prices that these commodities can be sold at. Because in India, well, previously at least, they had this system which is essentially called like the Mandi system, I believe I'm calling it right, the Mandi system. So this Mandi system gave far more control to the farmers as they represent their communities, and the system is centralized. And essentially it mandated that the state had minimum prices that the whatever company got, say it was like £1,000 or whatever the Indian currency is, for a kilogram of potatoes, right? That was the minimum amount that a corporation was legally obliged to pay to the farmers. So the farmers had a fixed income, right? They had a bottom that they knew, okay, so even if we only sell 1 kilogram, we know we're getting £1,000 or whatever, right? And of course that's not like a real, you know, life figure, that's just an example. But they would have a very sort of like, you know, they'd have a stable and understanding of their income and how to do it, which would give them more stability. Obviously they would know that they would be getting paid and how they would be getting paid, which is very important, because when you're a worker, particularly in a capitalist economy, this kind of instability that we're seeing in places like America, in places like the UK, is a consequence of anti-trade union laws and attacks on trade unions that go back as far as the Thatcher governments and the Reagan governments, that have continued to attack worker unionization, which has led to people being sort of separated from the workforce, separated from those around them who are able to fight against these corporations and truly, you know, collectively organize around these things. But membership in unions has been falling, which has led to a very sort of increase in this sort of gig economy. And this gig economy essentially means that now in America, over 70% of people are living paycheck to paycheck, because they are unable to live stable lives due to the fact that they are unable to organize and demand their basic rights as laborers and as a workforce: decent wages, decent access to public services, etc., etc. So what the corporations want to do, and what Modi's government of course wants to do, is they don't want that happening. Because when a government is legally obliged to protect the labor forces, when a government is legally obliged to ensure that the labor forces within the country are protected, it means that there is democratic force in that sense. Even if it is a representative government where there is not direct action available, these people are representatives that are elected, right? They have to, to some sense, be accountable towards the people. And even in that sort of shaky pseudo-democratic form, which most representative governments kind of represent and kind of act out in, because they're not particularly democratic even in this sort of facade of liberal democracy, there is still sort of force there through the ability to pass legislation, through the ability to go to the voting booth and use the ballot boxes to actually ensure that, hey, if farmers wanted to support a certain member of government and wish their government or their establishment or their executive to be pushed in, they were able to do that because it was democratically viable for them to do so, which is a massive threat to corporations, because everybody knows that corporations are authoritarian, tyrannical systems, right? They don't care about the laborers, they don't care about any democratic process, they simply care about a bottom line, they simply care about maximizing their margins, which means that any sort of democratic democratization of the economy, any sort of democratization of the market is a massive threat to them, because once the laborers, once the workers have more power, which is what socialists and communists alike and people on the left wing generally want to occur, it means that they lose profit, and it means that the surplus labor and the value from that, the surplus value, sorry, that the labor of these workers is generating is diverted more towards the laborers and rather into the pockets of the big fat cats at the top of the boardrooms. And this legislation that Modi is putting forward is Thatcheristic in its nature and is direct class warfare, because it is preventing that democratization from occurring. It is preventing a system that was already, you know, riddled with corruption, riddled with, you know, lack of sort of agency and power. I mean, these farmers aren't living prosperous lives, right? They are riddled with immense amount of economic insecurity already. To already put those people who are dealing with economic hardship, economic toil, and massive amounts of suicide, right? There was a man who committed suicide only 2 days ago, I saw on the news, during these protests, because they are unable to live off of their own produce. They're unable to live off of the work that they provide to these corporations, to the nation. I mean, these are people who are creating the spices, who are farming the potatoes, who are farming the rice that is exported from India. I mean, India is known for its culinary sort of culture, for its ability to export that culture across the world. And these farmers are responsible for that, because it is their labor that allows the Indian government to have such ties with businesses and corporations here in the UK, for example. I mean, the effects of colonization have had a direct link from India and Britain in essentially ensuring that the Indian trades and the Indian farmers are able to go to Britain at such prices. But of course, the corporations don't care about the laborers. They don't actually care about the people. And how do we know this, Mohammed? What is the actual legislation behind this? And we'll get straight into that right now. So the actual legislation being produced, there are three acts, or there are more to say, there are two acts and there are three sort of areas that are the focus of this, right? So the two acts are the Farmers Produce Trade and Commerce Promotion and Facilitation Act of 2020 and the Essential Commodities Amendment Act of 2020. So if we go into the first part, so the first part of the Farmers Produce Trade and Commerce Act of 2020 that we would want to focus on is essentially the part where it says that it expands the scope of trade areas, and this is the words that I got exactly from a Wikipedia article, I believe, but they took it from the legislative piece as well. So what it says is, these are the three bullet points we are first going to focus on. So it expands the scope of trade areas of farmers' produce from select areas to any place of production, collection, and aggregation. It allows electronic trading and e-commerce of scheduled farmers' produce and prohibits state governments from levying any market fee, cess, or levy on farmers, traders, and electronic trading platforms for trade of farmers' produce conducted in an outside trade area. So essentially what this means is, the third bullet point is the most important: prohibit state governments from levying any market fee, essentially abolishing the previously upheld mandi system, which dictated that certain prices must be met for the selling and trading of produce. And it essentially means that these predatory market forces and big corporations are let loose on the farmers, giving them far more power to determine what they want to pay, which will most assuredly, I mean, like, just think about, look at the damage that has been done to the mining towns, right? and the United States and the lower working class, right, and the work class and even the middle class, and the effects of these attacks on unionizations, it will mean that they will, the incomes that they will have and the payments that will be given to these farmers will be far lower than they earn now. And these farmers are already not rich. They don't have stock market portfolios. And India is a largely agricultural country with millions of people literally living off of the produce of their own land and the money that they can make from this. And in tandem with the COVID-19 pandemic, the inequalities in India have been exacerbated because Modi has also ignored the issues that stem from COVID-19, similar to Trump, similar to Boris Johnson. Because he's just like those people. He's very similar in this sort of right-wing Hindu populism, which is essentially just a front for fascism. And it's an absolutely terrible person, a terrible politician. He really is an Indian sort of Trump. But saying that would kind of be, you know, to sort of mystifying it. He's a terrible human being. These are real lives that are being affected by it. And they're being exacerbated by the fact that this government is essentially saying, we're no longer going to protect you. Because that's exactly what Thatcher did, right? Thatcher and Reagan said, the government is no longer going to protect these people. That is what deregulation is. People talk about deregulation as this ability to for economic opportunity, this ability to provide economic systems that give people more access to greater environments and greater, you know, market sort of decisions. That means that these people can expand their portfolios and, you know, enhance the economy. When really what it is, it's essentially like if you had a castle around the workers, and the castle people saying, oh, well, you're not allowed to live in the castle anymore. You have to live outside the castle now, and we're going to see what nature does with you. That is what deregulation is. It's instead of protecting the workers, protecting the laborers, it's giving them up to these predatory market forces and letting them loose on them, right? This is how exploitation starts. And again, I want to stress this, right? The callousness and the cruelty of these corporations, of these governments, is that what the fuck do they think they're going to get out of this? They're of course going to get millions, but how are they going to get millions out of this? They're going to suck these farmers dry. These farmers aren't rich. Sorry, pardon my, you know, I speak very quickly. Sometimes I get words wrong. But these farmers aren't rich, right? These farmers, as I said, don't have stock portfolios. But those people who do have stock portfolios really just want to suck every single penny they can get out of these people. It is a purely economic incentive to do such a thing, right? They just want to increase their margins. They just want to raise the bottom line because these people have no care or absolutely no incentive, right, in a purely profit-driven economy to care for these people, right? I mean, it's absolutely despicable. It is absolutely just pure evil, and it is purely the epitome of capitalism, what is going on right now. They don't want any protection for these farmers. These farmers that are already not making enough. But if we carry on with the legislation, right? The Farmers Empowerment and Protections Agreement on Pride Assurances and Farm Services Act of 2020. Oh, pardon me, it is three different acts. This is a different one to the Produce Trade and Commerce Act. Essentially, it says it provides a legal framework for farmers to enter into pre-arranged contract with buyers, including mention of pricing. And it defines a dispute resolution mechanism, right? I wrote this right here in my notes. This is legal exploitation at its finest. Not only are the laws themselves predatory and take massive amounts of power from these already weak farmers and these already poor farmers, but it is a clear threat to democratic legitimacy. But there is literally a legal framework, as it says in the legislation, for the predatory corporations to have a direct path into breaking down the labor force into nothing but another element of their stock portfolios to show to investors to make more money for themselves. There is a legal framework for these people to go into pre-arranged contracts. Everyone here should understand what a contract is. When you go into a contract, it is essentially a legal bargain, right? I'll give you this, you'll give me that. Here is it in a legal document so that we can ensure that if one side doesn't, you know, fulfill or meet the criteria or the standards or whatever, then we can take legal action against you, right? So it's a bargain. And when you're bargaining or when you're having trade deals with somebody like Brexit, that's a whole other video, you want to be on at least either an advantage or on an equal level playing field, right? You don't want to be at a disadvantage. Now, this legislation here puts farmers instantly at a disadvantage because what are the what are the choices here now? See, the previous choices were whatever happens, right, in our negotiations with the wholesale retail marketers, with the electronic trading companies, or with the big corporations, is that if we don't like the negotiations that they're putting forward to us, we can go to our Mandi representatives, right? The Mandi system is here to sort of protect us in a sense, even though it's been cut. At least it provides a bottom ground where we can, right, go to them and say, no, these people, legal action to ensure that the workers have the power in the negotiations, that the workers are able to kind of flex their muscles a bit and say, no, we're not going to provide anything for you guys. You guys are purely trying to exploit us. Here's the legal framework. But now the entire legal framework is kind of flipped. Because instead of the workers having the power, instead of the workers having the legitimate legal framework to sort of, you know, protect their income, protect their produce, now the corporations do. But why do corporations need sort of the government on the side with them? You see, this is the irony of this. Because what a lot of people say, this is, oh, this is less government, this is less, you know, the shackles of government bureaucracy. No, this is more government. This is more government for them. This is more government for the corporations. That's, you know, when Bernie Sanders kind of statement, you know, it's socialism for the rich and it's capitalism and corporatism and dirty dog for dog eat dog eats dog sort of world for the poor. And that's exactly what it is, because what these regulations, right, they are regulations, they're called deregulations, or they're regulations on workers. They tell workers what they can and cannot do. Oh, no, you don't have any power because of this legislation. You can't democratically organize. We don't want you to do that. And in fact, we're going to make it illegal for you to do so. We're going to make it so that these corporations can legally, and again, legally undermine you. Reducing these restrictions means that these workers are subject to private policy and boardroom executive decisions saying, we're no longer protecting you. And it also makes the political sphere far worse for the poor, because governments that represent them, that are supposed to represent them, no longer have power in that section. There is no reason, right? In politics, there is absolutely no reason, right, or incentive to prioritize or to put forward legislation for people that don't have any power or any authority over the economy or over whether you keep, you know, whether you stay in power or not. And that is exactly what they're doing. It tyrannicides, it makes the economy a tyranny, right? It makes it a dictatorship of the rich, where the powers of the farmers don't become a matter of public policy that are negotiated via, to at least some extent. Yes, okay, India is corrupt, for sure. I'm not defending Indian democracy here. In fact, you find me barely defending British democracy or any democracy, right? But rather, it is now at the mercy, they are rather now at the mercy of authoritarian corporations who don't care about these people. They don't. They simply don't care about these people. They don't want to boost the local economy. It's bullshit, right? It's frank bullshit. Like, let's not listen to these people. Let's not entertain their lies, their absolute tomfoolery and their absolute ass, right? I'm trying to be a bit nice. I'm trying to swear less, right? Or I would just say it's fucking bullshit, which sounds a bit nicer, actually. I might stick to swearing. But they will loosen the rules around the sale, pricing, and storage of farm produce, deregulation, not to help the local economy, so that they can make more money. It's always been about money to these people, because their money is their power, and they want to get as much of it as possible. The system has no place, absolutely no place for humanity, absolutely no place for kindness and dignity of workers, because that is essentially what they're making a massive middle finger to, and saying, fuck the workers, fuck your rights, fuck your humanity, we're going to make a corrupt system even more corrupt, right? The Mandi system gave Indian farmers in Punjab, right, because in the north of India, because that's particularly where it was sort of centralized around, where it was used the most, because it's very largely agricultural there. I mean, India is going through a process of industrialization right now, but a lot, I think around over 30% of people in India, I mean, this country is literally, like, you know, there's a billion fucking people in it, right? Like, literally, that's not even an exaggeration. A billion people live in India, right? These people are they live off the agriculture, right? They live off of an agricultural sort of economy. These are how the villages there sort of live off. These aren't the big cities, right, in the southeast or the southwest of India, right, on the coast. These are these farming villages, these farming towns that live off of this produce. And they need these things, right? And they just want to let loose these corporations. They want to deregulate it. And the Mandi system, which gave far more control to the farmers, right, and represented them to the best way that they possibly could, is no longer there. There's no longer a centralization, right? The Mandi system acted as a way for the distribution of agriculture between the farmers and private buyers, and the reforms mean that, it would lead to an end of these wholesale markets and assured prices. Because before this, the farmers could have confidence of the level of income that these people would have had. But the deregulation leads to far more volatility and completely gets rid of the power of the workers. And look at the deregulation. If you don't believe me, I mean, look at the deregulation over here. Look at the deregulation that occurred post-1980. That built up to 2008 because we let the banks loose, right? We're like, oh, fuck the banks. Oh, whatever. We'll just let the banks do whatever they want. We'll let the financial sector have fun because why not? I mean, while they were incarcerating black people in America, while they were destroying mining communities here in the UK, while they were doing God knows whatever the fuck they do in Europe, because Jesus Christ, I'm not going to go into their cultures. And they were, like, still exploiting their sweatshops. They were transferring labor to, you know, across other countries on the other side of the world, which essentially means building sweatshops where you can't see them anymore, so you can buy your phone without having the moral sort of responsibility of having to witness these horrors. Look what that happened. Look at the crash of the middle class, right? Look at the falling of unions. Look at the fact that people no longer have that stability in their life. That even though it was not perfect, the social democracies of the post-war period sort of provided. I mean, yeah, there was the racism, and yes, there was all these other influences. But economically, I mean, those are all social issues that we can also deal with. But those systems, if they were not for those social problems, could have also accounted for, right? The economically, these people kind of had a sort of stability in their lives, and then they were able to go to university, they were able to get higher educations, the middle class was able to expand and able to grow. That's why we had class de-alignment. The only reason why we had class de-alignment is because of the social democracy that sort of kind of made it so that there was far less of a gap between the proletariat and between the bourgeoisie, right? In terms of culture, in terms of access to materials, in terms of access to resources. And people kind of all attribute that to capitalism. No, it wasn't capitalism that sort of broke down class forces. In fact, if you see, because of 2008, these class forces have been made even more distinct. What occurred due to social democratic policies, due to trade unions, it meant that we could have this class de-alignment, which is ultimately, if anyone's ever fucking read Marx, what he wants a communist world where there is entire class de-alignment, where there is no longer a class society. It's a classless, stateless society, which we were getting close towards. But of course, the Thatcherite idiots, the fucking Reagan economists, right, the neoliberals sort of said, fuck that. And that's the exact same thing that's going on in India. But, and there's a big but our Indian brothers and sisters, they are not going out without a fight. And this is beautiful. I have never been more moved by a lot more protests. This is a protest that is absolutely stunning. Because a general strike, farmers from the north of India, from the Punjab area, right? This general strike, right? 250 million people, right? If it were a country, the strike alone, right? This protest alone, it would be the eighth most populated in the world. It is a task of monumental occasion put forward by these trade unions and these farmer unions working together. This is worker solidarity and a proletariat movement against capitalist forces at its finest, right? I mean, even Marx was wrong in this sense that, you know, the German, Germany or these European the proletariat would expand capitalism from there. I mean, I would definitely say he's wrong in that, because what is India doing right now, if not revolutionary? It is on par. It is larger than any of the Black Lives Matter protests we've seen in America. It is monumentous. 250 million? That is like four times, I believe, right? Like, it's like 60... It's like 60 million people who live in the UK. That's over four times the amount of people who live in the UK. 250 million, right? And it's non-violent, but they have been met with police brutality, unfortunately. And they have been met with disgusting violence from the Modi government. Because the Modi government is just like the Trump one, right? And I could speak for a year on what a piece of shit that Modi is. Modi is absolute scum of the earth, right? And he has used the same thing as Trump. nationalistic, xenophobic rhetoric to prevent the focus being on the economic inequality and decline of India's incredible unequal society, right? Because he's a fascist, right? He's this Hindu fascist. He has attacked Muslims, Pakistan. He's created division between Hindus and Muslims, and is, of course, you know, attacking the Sikhs, and he's inflated those sort of tensions between these different religions and sort of embraced and promoted this sort of Hindu nationalism, right? In order to attack people, in order to prevent people from unionizing, to see over this bullshit. But what the protesters, what the unions, what the trade representatives are showing us is that there is a way to ignore this bullshit. And it is bullshit, right? There's a way to ignore it and work together, because 250 million fucking people coming out for India, goddamn, that is amazing. That is absolutely amazing. And they worked together to represent themselves, which is an incredibly important lesson that all of us can learn, because we know now what 2020 has shown us is that behind a veil of ignorance, behind a veil of political rhetoric and division, is exploitation by the same people who claim to care about the country that they are representing. Trump, Macron, Johnson, Farage, what's occurring in Poland, Hungary, to the same extent what's going on in India. I know the exact same issues occur in Sudan. Hate and division are being used to prevent the proletariat from combining together and attacking and against and rising up against the forces of oppression that act globally. If there's anything we can learn with India, it's not only solidarity with our brothers and sisters over there to ensure that their support is met, but look at it. The media is ignoring them. The media doesn't want us to know what they can do, because they know exactly what kind of impact that will have on us. If we can see that India, and again, not to shit on India, but India isn't this technologically advanced world. It's not this communist utopia. It is riddled with inequality. It's riddled with a caste system that has led to massive social problems, right? And divisions that are absolutely brutal and ruthless, right? But if there is anything we can learn from it, is if that our Indian brothers and sisters can stand up against the bullshit, so can anyone. It is beautiful to see these Indian workers and these Indian protesters and farmers go against these people, because that is exactly what we needed to see in 2020. This is not a negative thing. This is a beautiful thing, and we need to stand in solidarity with them and fight with them as well, because the ignorance and exploitation, right, pardon me, you know, the ignorance that covers the exploitation, the ignorance that covers the exploitation, the ignorance being the hate and division, the racism, the sexism, right, the classism, right, the stereotypes and the bullshit that we all face are the exact same things that are being used over there to prevent us from seeing how the economic forces of our society can be fairer, can be more just, and we can fight against them. And this is a lesson to be learned for everybody here, which is why we have to fight against racism, which is why we have to fight against you know, sexism and the patriarchy, but which is also why we have to fight against Eurocentrism, where we have to focus on not only our nations, not only on these first world quote-unquote nations. We also need to fight against oppression that is occurring across the world, even if it is on the other side, which is why worker solidarity, right? Marx said it, right? Workers of the world, unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains, okay? We have nothing to lose but our chains. But that only comes about if we work together. If we can see that the hate that Johnson, Farage and Trump are peddling is something used as a diversion to get at the real issues underlying our system. And real change only comes about when we can overcome that division, overcome that hatred, and stand in solidarity with one another. It's incredibly important that we learn from these protests and we support these protests. I do try to make everything a learning opportunity, something that we can take something out of. But it is important we support these people, because these people are life or death situations. And seriously, right? Suicide has been a massive issue in North India because of the economic instability. And these are real people, man. These are Indians who live just like we do, who are people our age, who are people who eat, drink, sleep, have sex, love and learn just like we do. And they are human beings that we need to support. We need to stand with our Indian brothers and sisters, and we need to support them, and we need to share this message, because the media is not representing it, but we will represent them. If their fucking government doesn't want to talk about it, we will, and we will share this, and we will ensure that everybody gets to hear exactly what they need to. The bullshit
needs to be uncovered. We need to overcome it, but we need to stand with our Indian brothers and sisters and hopefully fight against them. And that is why I stand in solidarity with India and will try to, as much as I can, educate myself around the topic and ensure that I am helping spread the message of the exploitation and the oppression that our Indian brothers and sisters and the farmers and workers over there are going through. Because as I said, injustice anywhere is an injustice everywhere. Thank you very much to listening to this week or month or whatever fucking time period I upload podcasts at. And remember, the lessons from this one are a particularly important one. I hope you have learned something. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Like, comment, subscribe, do all that amazing stuff. I don't really care. Just take the lessons learned from this. Stand in solidarity with India and stand in solidarity with your brothers and sisters, no matter what race, color, country, or fight they are fighting. We are all fighting a common fight because there is a common humanity that underlies all of us. Thank you for listening. It's been a pleasure to speak to you. I'm Mohammed Hassan, and that is the Left Wing Propaganda Machine.